So, Oren, thank you for joining me. So you're bringing litigation on behalf of Palestinian victims at the ICC against Israeli officials. Can you tell us a bit about it?
What is particular in this case, I think there were other submissions on genocide, but this case is not about genocide, the crime of genocide as such. It focuses on a different crime, a separate crime, of incitement to genocide. Essentially, analyzing statements of eight Israeli nationals, six officials, and two, let's say, influentials, who are appearing in the media, we established that these individuals were directly and publicly calling others to commit genocide. And an analysis of this crime showed that it's an independent crime, separate from the crime of genocide on any other ICC crime. And what is particular and sui generis in this mode of responsibility is that you don't need to prove or establish that the primary crime, in this case it's genocide, has been committed or even attempted. And therefore, it's a very solid case because I would say no one would, it's not really in dispute that these statements by these very senior Israeli officials and journalists and a retired major general amount to the crime of incitement to genocide.
Do you have any expectations of a positive ruling being enforceable?
Yeah, enforcement, it's a difficult and separate question, but what we, given the controversy over is it a genocide, is it not a genocide, is there intent, is there a relation between the intent and the actions on the ground? Personally, the atrocities for me personally, whether we call it genocide plus, genocide minus, doesn't change a lot. But what it enables the prosecutor is to prosecute this very important crime. And it's only incitement and only incitement to genocide that is singled out and doesn't require to prove the main crime. And the question is why? And this is why where I'm getting at why the prosecutor is likely to prosecute this crime is because from past cases, and it appears in other instruments, other treaties, not only the Rome Statute, also the ICTY, the ICTR, and the Genocide Convention, of course, is the understanding that a genocide cannot be committed unless people are incited, because genocide also typically is committed by many people, many individuals. It's a joint criminal enterprise. So you need to normalize the genocidal act. You need to dehumanize the targeted population to the extent that it will be accepted and therefore incitement to genocide. If you cannot commit genocide without incitement that precedes it or accompany it, if the inciters are typically are the most responsible actors for a potential genocide, if incitement is the harm is the creation of the risk of genocide, and if genocide is the most serious crime, therefore, there is a really huge public interest of the international community, sorry, to prosecute this crime. So, realpolitik aside for a second, the factual analysis, what we provide the prosecutor, is a straightforward, so very straightforward. I mean, if you look at past cases of incitement to genocide in the case law, they are much more ambiguous. They are much more, even the Crokets speech or the media case in Rwanda and so on. Never before people were manifesting their inciting genocidal statements as the Israeli officials and the other.
Would a positive ruling on this case, I mean, were this case to go through, would it count towards showing essentially intent, or would it actually buttress the ICC bigger case on not on genocide, but on famine and potentially the ICJ going forward case?
Yeah, that's the interesting. So there are, to your question, there are again two additional layers or elements that we won't have to do it in the case. It's enough that we, rely on the ICC and the international criminal law as such and the Rome Statute to make the case. But what we show the prosecutor is essentially two things. The first is that across the street of the ICC, there is another court. It's called the International Court of Justice, and they are adjudicating right now the case brought by South Africa under the Genocide Convention. And they ruled in January 2024 that there is a plausible risk of commission of genocide. This plausibility standard for the ICJ, what we did in our case, we translated it and kind of comparative analysis showed that it corresponds to the evidentiary standard of the ICC that we call reasonable grounds to believe that there is a genocide. Therefore, this standard is the requisite standard for extending the investigation to investigate and prosecute incitement to genocide, including the issuing of arrest warrants. This is one point. Second point is that the ICJ had to establish plausibility in order to issue the interim measures that they ordered against Israel. Again, ICJ is about the state of Israel, and ICC is about the state agents, right? And different subjects of different laws, but they adjudicate the same matter in the real world, right? So the ICJ, once they established plausibility and granted the interim measures, they granted six. The third one ordered the Israeli government to prosecute and punish incitement to genocide. The ICJ cited three out of the eight suspects in our case as potential inciters. By the way, the Israeli judge at the ICJ, the former Chief Justice of the Israeli Supreme Court, Aaron Barak, he joined this interim measure, the provisional measure, sorry. So he believed first, the Israeli judge believed that first it is plausible that there is a risk of genocidal acts in Gaza because this without it, he could not join this provisional measure. And second, he believed that there is a incitement to genocide to prosecute and punish. Okay, so on top of the doctrinal law of the ICC and the international criminal law, across the street, there is enough evidence we show to prosecute this crime. And actually, the prosecutor doesn't need to do much because the point of departure can be what the ICJ already ordered.
Can you tell me a bit about some of these cases or some of these examples? I mean, I guess one of the things that comes to mind quite immediately is Netanyahu's citation of the passage on Amalek.
We dedicate quite a lot to the analysis of the statement, including of Netanyahu. So if to start with Netanyahu, when an incitement needs to be direct and public, and public, it goes without saying through the media today, but direct, it means you analyze it in the context, the cultural and linguistic context in which it was made. And when me as an Israeli, and I think any Jewish person across the globe, I'm reminded of Amalek, I know first that the order is to kill not only combatants, but and not only civilians, but also children and women, and including the animals. Amalek, I think there are three different stories in the Bible. So in one is just after the Exodus from Egypt, where God promised, I think Moses to eradicate Amalek, but it's like twofold promise. One is the existence of Amalek, and second is the memory of Amalek. And the memory, if you wish, it's when you're talking about a genocidal project where you destroy the universities, you destroy the hospitals, you destroy the houses, you destroy the cultural sites, you destroy the mosques and the churches. You could see that it's go beyond the physical extermination of the targeted group. And the second story where Amalek is in the Bible is the King Saul is ordered to have no mercy on Amalek, and he does have mercy on Amalek, and therefore he loses his kingdom. So the analogy being, if you will have mercy, you will lose. You know, it really plays on the existential threat that the Israeli Jewish community was genuinely feeling post October 7th, and instrumentalize it to react. We have to have no mercy. You know, again, President Herzog, it's an entire nation that is, there are no non involved. Gallant, no food, they are human animals. Again, this you have to dehumanize the targeted group to enable or normalize such a genocidal project. All restraints have been removed, eliminate everything. This is still Gallant. Okay? Cuts. No water, not a drop of water until, and the order is to leave immediately. So displacement, expulsion, but also to leave the world. So to kill everyone. And we can go on and go on with Gallant and with of course, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. This is a walk in the park in terms of the litigation. But the third story of Amalek is Tziklag, Hebrew settlement. Some experts say it's really close to Gaza, and that Amalek destroyed and kidnapped women and children, and then the King David is retaliating and liberating the hostages and so on and so on. So you see, it's the two mitzvahs of Amalek: not to forget what Amalek did to you, and to obliterate Amalek. Netanyahu knew very well what he was saying and who he was speaking to in terms of the intended audience.
How would you say that the Israeli public, by and large, has understood the message when Netanyahu came out and said, you know, do not forget what Amalek did to you?
My understanding, again, we are talking about two communities. Both are now, at the moment, today when we speak, are in severe post-traumatic, collectively speaking, state. And so we didn't have to make a lot of effort for the message to be conveyed, and it was conveyed across the board. It's not a certain political camp, as you made, if I got you, where you are heading with your, it, yeah, there is the fundamentalistic Mosaic vision of the settlers and you know, the Rabbi Cook movement and so on. But also the center, also the there is no left, but let's say it's the liberal center in Israel. There was no distinction. Hamas is ISIS, there are Nazis, and all these analogies that were not only, you know, sometimes you could say it was made in the heat of the moment, no, and because of it was a day or two after. But first, we show statements that go along the year. And even now, like yesterday or the day before yesterday, I heard a very famous, an ex-football player that is now a Jordan, an anchor in one of the shows in Israel, was saying, like, no, we have to kill the children because the children will become terrorists and so on. And you have Major General Allen saying, yeah, the women are, and the sisters are of Hamas, you know, and who is Hamas? Also the teachers and the doctors. And even when they assassinate journalists, they say it's a Hamas Hasbara unit to as if to normalize the killing. So in Israel, in the Israeli public, until today, I mean, nothing that I'm saying is a justification, but we have to, you know, to make the distinction between what we justify and what we say to understand what is going on. So I can understand why everyone was feeling that way. But it's not justifiable. Just as, you know, you cannot justify what Hamas was doing on October 7, in my view, against civilians, Even though there is, of course, the context of siege, occupation, apartheid, 20 years you close people in these conditions, and then you should not be surprised that they come out as such, you know. And so just there is a, as there is a context to the October 7th atrocities, also October 7th is the context for the atrocities committed in Gaza thereafter. So it's not a specific fraction within the Israeli public. It's really across the board from there is no, this is a consensus.
How confident are you that international law, generally speaking, and everything that goes with it, including potential positive rulings in this case and others, can survive the current state of politics? I mean, particularly a Trump White House and a very weak European political sphere.
I'm not, in short, but I don't see any other option because of the consequences. So if you have the ICJ, you know, even in a few years ruling it was or it wasn't a genocide, let's say it was a genocide, there is no sanction. Only the ICC, with its competence over individuals, can put people in prison. You cannot put the Israeli government or state in prison, right? So, and if to take just a step back, and specifically on this case, beyond how solid and like there is no dispute on fact or law, the pretrial chamber that issued the arrest warrants against two of the eight suspects here, Netanyahu and Gallant, already pronounced, already determined that they created, which they being and the Israeli campaign in general, the inflicted conditions calculated to bring about the destruction of part of the group. This is word by word from the, it's not really a decision, kind of the press release on the decision of the issued arrest by the ICC. And they didn't, they didn't have to use this. This is word by word, one of the genocidal acts in the Rome Statute, creating living conditions calculated to bring about the destruction of part of the group. Yeah, there are a lot of pushbacks, but this is what the fight is about. No one, if you would have told me before the prosecutor applied for arrest warrants that he will do that, I would say you are joking, you know? Because of this pro-Western, anti-African tendency of this court, you know, the highly politicized, it was a huge step.
What is your general assessment of the current state of international law, particularly in relation to, say, enforcement?
You are right in the sense that the ICC now positioned itself or is cornered, that it can be, someone has to lose. It's either going to be the Israeli officials or the ICC in terms of legitimacy and so on. And it's true, what, everything you said about governments, kind of in the beginning they were supportive, then they tried to back off, they started to back off. But it's more complex than that, you know, this like a praxis or dialectic of power. Why? Because also in our case, but in any other international criminal law case, what the Israeli government doesn't do, and they don't do anything, vests jurisdiction with the ICC. But everything that the ICC doesn't do allows national jurisdictions, either on the basis of the concept of universal jurisdiction or just national jurisdiction, doesn't matter, to prosecute this crime at the national level. So when a head of government say, this person is not a persona non grata or anything, still there are some states that the judiciary is independent and the judge can decide otherwise.
Thank you very much. We're unfortunately completely out of time, but I appreciate your time and your expertise, and we hope to have you again on.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.